Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, we'll be looking at Healing the Wounds of War, an inside view into Catholic chaplaincy for the armed services. And the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta tells us how the Catholic Order got its very cumbersome official name, and about the self-sacrificing work the Knights have been known for in their 900-year-old mission to care for the sick and the world's outcast. A living hell, far from home, shell-shocked and under fire. The life of a soldier on the battlefield or the officer struggling to keep the peace on the Green Line is a lonely one, full of the unknown, of death, injury, and raw fear. Will I ever see my family again? Where, amidst this hell, can there be a God? These are but just some of the pressing anxieties and questions members of the armed forces must live with at war, and two, the living phantoms of their fears and horrific experiences that continue to haunt them upon their return home. Often, many in the armed forces turn to their chaplains, seeking answers to life's most difficult and existential questions. Queries like, what happened to the merciful, the loving, and forgiving God we've come to know? Why has God forsaken us? Even those who don't believe turn to chaplains, hoping for a word of comfort, encouragement, and support.
We've got chaplains in the three services, the Navy, the Army, and the Royal Air Force here.
Bishop Richard Moth heads the Catholic chaplaincy for the armed forces in Britain. He told Lydia O'Kane, it's a humbling job.
And I'm bishop for all of those, and also bishop for Catholic personnel and their families, wherever they are in the world. So I have a diocese with no boundaries, really. We've got numbers of chaplains. We could always do with a few more, but any bishop in any diocese will say that about his numbers of priests. So I think in terms of encouraging the chaplains that we have at the moment, I'm meeting with them. I'm seeking opportunities as time goes along to meet with them individually, to pray with them, to visit where they are. So I'm getting around to see people and to meet with chaplains and those whom they serve. And, you know, that's certainly going to be a kind of continuing, pretty much non-stop program in this particular role as bishop. So it's very much one of presence and support and listening to them and praying for them and with them. And kind of seeking really to serve the chaplains so that they can better serve those in their care. I think that's the way I envisage it.
I was just thinking when you were talking and just looking at, you know, all those soldiers who work on the front line, they must feel that they need God a little bit closer when they're, and therefore the need for a chaplain must be all the more urgent sometimes. Do chaplains find that, or have you found that in the past?
The chaplains do find that. I think combat challenges faith in many ways, obviously. It brings about questions in people's minds. Some people And, you know, looking back through history, one sees this. Some people have found faith in war, and for others it's had the reverse effect. It's made faith very difficult for them. And I think to have a chaplain there when you're looking at those questions, when you're facing death in the face, is really very, very important. And I know that our chaplains are playing a very key role in the whole business of care of casualties. They're there with them in the hospitals, very much part of the team in the medical sphere, and that presence is appreciated not just by the casualties but by the staff too. And even if you have a soldier who or a service person who doesn't have a particular faith, the chaplain is somebody who's kind of aside from the chain of command, to whom they can turn, and that's valued too. So the chaplain's role in the armed services is a very broad one, and very significant for the people that that he serves.
You're dealing with so many different things. It's very diverse. You're dealing with grief, bereavement. You're dealing with counselling. You're dealing with prayer. You're dealing with there's an awful lot rolled into one in that role, and therefore the chaplain has to adapt to dealing with all of these kinds of issues.
That's right. Yes, and of course he's got his own training as a priest and experience in a diocese before he comes to the bishopric of the forces. And then you add to that the training that he does in the Navy, Royal Air Force or Army to enable him to fulfill a role in that setting. So the level of training is high, and you know he's with his ship or his squadron or his brigade or regiment or wherever he's posted, and he works with them and trains with them, so he becomes one of the family in that sense, someone that is known to everyone, and really has a place at the heart of things. So and I think we must also bear in mind, and I would certainly ask all your listeners to pray especially or specifically at some point for the chaplains, because they need a lot of support in their role too. And they're with people in these difficult circumstances, they're absorbing a lot. And the support of people's prayer in their work is really important to them.
These prayers give the chaplains new strength to combat the doubts and reinforce the faith of their conflict-hardened flock. Such prayers, in a sense, have been institutionalized in national days to remember war veterans and those who have fallen in conflict. To mark the end of World War I at the 11th hour of the 11th month in 1918, many countries established an Armistice Day, a special national holiday to remember their war dead and veterans. In the U.S., it's called Veterans Day. In the UK, it's Remembrance Day. It's important that a nation stand behind its troops and support them in prayer, says Bishop Moth. And those Remembrance Days help remind us of the causes and injustices of war so that future generations will not repeat the errors of their predecessors.
It's important to recognize sacrifice. The sacrifice of others. And if we think about it in civil life, there are lots of different ways in which people recognize the sacrifice of people in other contexts. But I think with Remembrance Sunday, we're remembering obviously those who've died in warfare at the defense of their country and their loved ones. And I think it's important for us to continue to do that so that people can learn the lessons of history, really, and also to pray for those who've died and for their families. In terms of the present situation, you know, we've got families who have loved ones serving overseas. We've got families who very sadly have experienced the loss of loved ones right now. You know, we're reading about it in the papers daily and getting news back from Afghanistan about it all the time. And that does heighten people's awareness, and it heightens their need for prayer and the concern of others. Tragic events for the families and for their countries, they do kind of, I think, bring home to people the need for reflection, for prayer, for turning to God at these times to seek aid and consolation and a deepening of faith.
While we're invited to remember and pray for the fallen soldiers in war and their families, we must never forget the veterans, especially those living with the scars of fear and conflict.
It's right that we remember those who've died. But also, I would certainly ask everybody to pray for those who are casualties. You know, we're seeing very bad wounding going on, some fairly grisly casualties coming back from theatre. And it's important to pray for them as they face rehabilitation, as they face a very often a very different way of life, living with injury, both physical and psychological too. You know, people find they come back and they find it difficult to talk about what they've seen. We must pray for them and also pray for their families, because families, they are waiting anxiously at home for news of their loved ones. And when they do have relatives who come back, who may be wounded or who are having difficulties coming to terms with their experience, then the forces' families need a lot of prayer and support at this time too.
Bishop Richard Moth of the Chaplaincy for Britain's Armed Forces. So many of us, in every level of society, he says, have never known the ravages of war for ourselves. It is difficult, perhaps impossible, for us to understand all that our service personnel and their families are experiencing. May none of us forget, he says, that the greatest act of remembrance we can make for those who have given their lives in war, the best witness and support we can give to those who bear the scars of conflict, either as service personnel or their families, is to strive for justice and truth. For justice and truth drive out fear and are the foundations for lasting peace. It's one of the oldest orders in the Catholic Church. The Order of the Knights of Malta dates back more than 900 years, drawing on a past devoted to the care of pilgrims to the Holy Land. Today, it is a vibrant source of church aid to refugees, victims of disasters, the poor, and those in need of medical care. Emer McCarthy spoke to the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing, about the order's history and ministry.
Well, we're here with Fra Matthew Festing, who has the title of the Grand Master of the Sovereign Military Hospital Order of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes, and of Malta, more familiarly known to most of our listeners as the Order of Malta. It's a very long title, but for a very ancient religious order, one of the oldest in the Catholic Church. But can you tell our listeners what exactly all those words together mean?
Well, now, it's a great question, and you're quite right, it's far too long. But, of course, if you've been going for a very long time, in a way, you can sort of collect things together. If we'd all been in one place all the time, then I suppose that we wouldn't have such a complicated name. Equally, you can say somebody like the Benedictines, much older than we are, but they've stuck with one name. It's an accident of history. So sovereign, the sovereignty of the order was given to the order and not on the basis of, as it were, owning a country. It was given to the order by the Holy Father at the beginning of the 11th century. So that's where that dates from. And then it's by extension, of course, it was also because they were sovereign, as it were, over Rhodes and then Malta. So that's where that comes from. So that's the first one. Then there's the word military. And military, of course, is a complete mistranslation. Because it's nothing to do with being a soldier, it's nothing to do with fighting, it's a translation of the Latin word for a knight. And so the answer is, it comes from miles, it comes from the, as it were, the idea that they were a knightly person. And it's become, it's a word that you can't really translate satisfactorily into English. And it's been translated as military, but it isn't really quite what it means. So, where do we go after that? Hospitaller.
Hospitaller's
easy because we have spent our time, 900 years of it, looking after the sick. Again, it's complicated because the word hospitalier, as it were, for instance, in French, means something in French, and hospitaller doesn't mean a great deal in ordinary English. So, again, it's rather a difficult word to translate into English. But it's pretty obvious what it means. It means that we are looking after the poor and the sick with a particular medical direction in how we do it. So that's how that works. Order then comes from the fact that it's an order of the church, like being any other order. Then we go from there to St. John, and the answer is that we are patronists of St. John the Baptist, although scholars will tell you that maybe at the very, very beginning, we might have been dedicated to St. John the Almoner, who was a rather obscure Middle Eastern saint, and much less well-known than St. John the Baptist. But certainly for the last 850 years, St. John the Baptist has been our patron. Then we go to Jerusalem, because that's where we were founded. That's where the thing, you know, that's where its origins are. Then, of course, when the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem ceased, we then went on a rather roundabout journey from Jerusalem to Acre, Acre to Cyprus, and Cyprus to Rhodes, so that's where the Rhodes bit comes in. And then after the fall of Rhodes, we went to Malta. And then, thank goodness, when we left Malta, they stopped adding more silly things on. Otherwise, we could be from Rome or anywhere else. But the answer
or Russia.
Well, you know, it's really complicated. But that's why there is this extraordinarily long title. And, of course, it's also why the whole thing is, that's why we're still known as the Knights of St. John or the Knights of Malta, because it's much easier to say so.
You have, of course, a motto. The motto of your order is, do you want to say it?
How do you mean the motto? Do you mean that the two charisms of the order, obsequium pauperum and tuitio fidei, is that what you're saying? Right. Well, obsequium pauperum means that it's the, as it were, the care and the as it were, the looking after, if you like, of the poor and the sick. It's as it were, paupery is obviously is the poor, but by extension, it's also sick people as well. And then tuitio fidei is also very often mistranslated in English because lots of people describe it as the defence of the faith, and it's not what it means. To a degree, of course, it is the defence, but it really, tuitio is the same word as tuition, and that, of course, means of the business of nurturing, encouraging, like tuition, like a tutor with a pupil. A pupil goes to the chap to be taught and to have his knowledge increased. And so again, tuitio fidei means the encouragement, the nurturing, the teaching of the faith. So that's where that comes from.
Of course, we cannot leave out that it was a very important chapter in the history of the order and also a very important chapter in the history of the island. Would you like to take us through that period very briefly, if one can? It's very difficult to summarise.
Very, very brief, of course. What happened was that when the order was forced by the Turks to leave Rhodes, and that is a long story in itself, but when they were forced to leave Rhodes, they needed a home. They also had a powerful fleet, and at that stage, although they continued with their hospitaller works, they also were quite a considerable, particularly naval, but also military power. And therefore it suited the Emperor Charles V very well to give them somewhere to go in order to help him defend Western Christendom. And by chance, he gave us the island of Malta. I suppose he might have given us, for the sake of argument, the island of Corsica, say, I don't know, but what happened is that it ended up by being Malta. And that's where that long association from the first part of the 16th century to the very end of the 18th century came from. And so we were in Malta for that whole period of jolly nearly 300 years. I think it's something like 278 years or 280 years, roughly. It's that sort of period of time. So that's where the association of one and the other comes from. Then, of course, it was the longest period that the order actually ruled in a sovereign sense, ruled the territory. So again, it's very, very much part of the history of the island of Malta from that point of view. And then, of course, there were one or two other significant events which took place during that period. The most important one, I suppose, is the siege of Malta in 1565. And so it was really the first time that the advance of the Turks in a westerly direction was definitely halted and they were sent packing. And therefore it was hugely important both for the Maltese people and for the island and indeed for the whole of Western Europe. Otherwise we perhaps would all have remained, I don't know for how long, but certainly when you think about it, the Ottoman Empire continued right up until the First World War. If it hadn't been for the Siege of Malta, perhaps we would all have been ruled by the Ottomans until comparatively recently. How does one know? But that's, from that point of view, it's a very important aspect of Maltese history. And, of course, the defence, part of it was carried out, of course, by the Maltese people themselves, but the leadership was provided by the members of the Order.
Was that, of course, the siege you're speaking about, was that the siege during which La Valletta, the famous master of the Order of Malta, general, he was one who really orchestrated the defences of Malta, and he's been honoured in Maltese history since. Most importantly, of course, the capital of Malta is named after him.
Of course. I mean, at the time of the siege, the harbour, what we now know as the Great Grand Harbour of Valletta, was, in fact, a natural harbour, which is why, of course, the Turks wanted it and why we were busily defending it. But at that particular time, the central peninsula in the harbour had nothing on it at all. It had a fort at one end, the fort of St. Elmo, which is where a lot of the siege was conducted from and a lot of the fighting took place. But in fact, the rest of the peninsula was simply bare ground. After the defeat of the Turks, the Order then decided that it needed a capital. And because of the importance of the victory, of course, the whole of Europe was quite prepared to, as it were, to support the Order and pay for the building of this huge city. And this, and not only just the city itself, but the huge fortifications. And in fact, anybody who knows about fortifications will tell you that the thing that the Order built in Valletta, that vast, vast complex of bastions, is really, it's the sort of 16th century equivalent of the atom bomb. If you have it, you're not going to get attacked, and therefore you don't ever have to defend it. If you have the atom bomb, nobody's going to attack you for fear that you might drop it on them. So in a way, it's a rather sort of similar idea, because in fact, until the Second World War, until the Germans and Italians tried to get Malta from the British, those fortifications were never, ever challenged, not once. So that's where, that's the importance in many respects of Valletta. And then, as you say, because the Grand Master was this huge sort of huge hero, obviously within the Order and within the island, but indeed for the whole of Europe, that's why the city was named after him. And it's a very odd fact that even Protestant England rang every church bell it could find in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, in as it were, celebration of the victory. Very odd for a distant Protestant country to do, but that's what did happen.
Something that perhaps is less commonly, people are less commonly aware of, is the work that was going on in the hospital that the Order had on Malta, avant-garde medical research, because this, of course, was the main mission also of the Order, was to care, where you took in people to the hospital regardless of their faith, I mean, immigrants and merchants, regardless of their faith, regardless of their culture, their creed, and, of course, you cared for them. This is also another very important aspect of the Order's work, an aspect that's still very important to the Order today.
It's nothing new, if you like. I mean, it's what we happen to be doing at the moment, but it's an extension of what we've always done. If you read the very first rule of the Order, which was drawn up by Raymond Dupuy at the very, very beginning, he was the second Grand Master, it doesn't mention a single word about having a navy or an army or bearing arms or carrying a sword. There's not a single word in it. But it says the object of the exercise is to look after the sick. That's what it says in the rule. And it's quite easy to read. It makes it perfectly clear what we should be doing. And that's what we have always done, even while we've been doing other bits and pieces. So both in Jerusalem and at Acre and in Cyprus and in Rhodes and on Malta itself and indeed ever since, we've always cared for the sick. Now, we've done it in different sorts of ways. Sometimes we've had hospitals. Sometimes we've help people who have been the victims of war, sometimes the victims of natural disasters, earthquakes and so forth and so on. Nothing new in that either. And indeed, looking after refugees has been a long tradition of doing that. And so, unsurprisingly, as well as, for instance, being involved in the L'Aquila earthquake, for instance, quite recently in Italy, and in the present earthquake in Haiti, we're very much involved there, We're also very much involved in the business of trying to look after some of these refugees who arrive. And, of course, it's not... I wish it was just you mentioned North Africa, but, of course, it's a much bigger problem than that, because there are people arriving in the southern coasts of Europe from all over Africa, all over the Middle East, and even from the Far East. And, for instance, not very long ago, I did a visit to Lampedusa, and there seem to be people from practically every part of the world, except North and South America, and Europe. So there are people from the whole of Africa, right across Asia, right as far away as China, who are coming into Europe. So what we're doing there is assisting the local, as it were, the Italian authorities, the Italian Coast Guard, and providing the medical cover for these people. And once these people, a lot of them, of course, have been adrift in small boats for days, by the time they're picked up, they're very often in a very bad state. And then, in addition to all that, of course, in due course, a lot of them come up into the middle part of Europe, so we're also busily caring for them in other places too, notably in Germany, notably in Belgium, to a degree also in France. And it's a big, big problem. It's a movement of peoples. It's a serious challenge for the whole of Europe. And, for instance, you only have to see the various immigrants. Not all the immigrants that you see, for instance, here in Rome. They're by no means all from Africa. They're also not from Asia, but an awful lot of them are out of Eastern Europe. So, again, we have schemes running in various places which are looking after these people, too. So, again, it's partly to do an extension of what we did for pilgrims going to Jerusalem all those centuries ago, partly an extension of that, and it's partly also a business of providing the medical cover for some of these people, because a lot of them arrive. Not very many elderly people arrive, but an awful lot of young people and indeed people with children. So, for instance, some of our medical people on the boats with the Italian Coast Guard have even delivered babies on board. So it is extraordinary. The range of, as it were, medical expertise which is required to look after these people. There are so many people and the problems are so great that I'm sure we'll be there. We've been going for nearly 1,000 years. I guess we'll be going for another 1,000 years, probably, just dealing with the problems of those countries alone.
And a warm thanks there to the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta, Fra Matthew Festing. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.